In Asia, where many of our grandfather teachers came from, the culture tends to be a little bit more laid back, and so they need much more encouragement to effort. Whereas here, where everything's about being goal-driven and achievement and competition and all of that, we actually need to learn to relax a little bit. And it took the teachers a while to figure that out, that the old story about Ajahn Chah and, the person's walking down the levee and he says, "Go right, go right, go right." And his other student says, "Yes, but when I was up there, you kept telling me, go left, go left, go left." Well, there's no absolutes in this instruction, right? It's all about balance. And so in this culture, we need a little bit more balance to the side of relaxation. It doesn't mean that we need to be lax or that we need to be sloughing over or that we need to be not caring. What it means is that the balance that we need often is on the end of relaxation. So rather than translating virya as effort or energy, Kamala uses the term gentle, persevering effort. It's more on the idea of the perseverance of it rather than the effort of it, a gentle, persevering effort. And if we think of starting over as the practice, then that perseverance is built in, right? Because we know, oh, I've started over again. I've started over again. My perseverance is really doing well today. Right? Instead of saying, oh, my mind slipped off. I must not have been using enough energy. I better, buck up and, throw back the shoulders and puff out the chest and hit it hard. Right? Because that's sometimes the attitude, and I'm speaking from experience here. So, setting the intention, letting it go, like we did in the sitting, it is helpful to have the support of that intention. And then coming back again and again, whether you're doing a concentration practice, a shamatha practice, or your open awareness, just coming back again and again. And the result of this is that each moment is new. And we hear this. And in the Abhidhamma, they actually talk about these mind moments, these little discrete, Steve Armstrong calls them pixels of experience. It's just this little, one pixel without the other ones, it's hard to recognize, right? But you put them all together on the screen, and it's, these graphics can be convincing, as if they're real. Same thing with our own experience. We have one little pixel. And then the next pixel, and the next, and the next, and the next. Pretty soon, we're convinced that there's actually someone here, despite reality and despite the Buddhist teaching that it's all just an illusion, right? It's all just back in the days of film, movies. We used to use the analogy of, you've got these frames flipping by at however many times a second it is, so that they appear to be a moving image, and it's actually a succession of still pictures. Same thing with the pixels of experience. Each one is a unique moment arising and passing away. String them all together, and we have what feels like a continuous flow of experience. So each moment, but actually each moment is completely new. And in this practice, we believe that not only the experience, but the consciousness arises and passes away each moment. So we talk about hearing consciousness, smelling consciousness, tasting consciousness. Those arise with the contact between the sense object and the sense door. And when the sound, for example, touches a healthy ear, hearing consciousness arises. When the sound goes away, consciousness goes away. Some other one arises. In this case, my seeing consciousness took back over. As soon as that sound stopped, I noticed I was looking. My eyes were open the whole time. I didn't notice I was looking because I was focusing on the sound. So hearing consciousness arises, passes away. Seeing consciousness arises and passes away. Generally, in sort of daily life like this, we're able to convince ourselves that these things are sort of on the scale of maybe several seconds, right? Even though they're instantaneous. I don't know, this is a timeless practice, but I think some people have done studies and it's like I think there's 200 mind moments in a second or something like that. You know, it rises and passes away very quickly. But to actually know that each moment is new, and that actually, whether we're conscious of it or not, we're starting over all the time. Each moment, there's a rising and a passing away. So Mahasi Sayadaw is a traditional Burmese teacher. He's our great-grandfather teacher. And he's the one that really brought this practice to lay people in Burma. And he wrote this manual of insight that some of us are studying and probably will be for the rest of our lives. It was just translated and brought into English by Stephen Kamala and their foundation. And just to show you that there's no need to judge our practice when we slip off the object, I found this quote. This is on the Viplasa's, the Corruptions of Insight. And this one's on sloth and torpor. Sometimes sloth and torpor, you know, dullness of mind. Yeah, sloth being the body having no energy and torpor the mind being dull. So it's one of the five hindrances. So sometimes one's practice may go so smoothly and comfortably that objects and awareness gradually become faint and one eventually drifts off into a state of oblivion. One may even fall asleep for quite a long time. When one wakes up and resumes practice, one will find that it goes as smoothly as before without any sloth or torpor. So, you know, there's not a hint of judgment in that practice, right? It doesn't say, oh, the antidote for sloth and torpor is to pull your earlobes and... Remember that one? We used to do that, you know. Yeah, no. It's, hey, when you wake up, just keep on going because, you know, you will still be able to practice, and in fact, it'll go without any sloth and torpor when you wake up. So, good advice. I don't know how many of you have read this book, Path with Heart, Jack Kornfield. Yeah. I've talked to more people, including myself. I talk to myself a lot. I've talked to so many people who were reading this book when they came to Vipassana practice. It's amazing. And I was one of them. I was reading through this book, A Path with Heart. You can always tell the book's by Jack Kornfield because it has the word heart in the title. This particular one's called A Path with Heart, A Guide Through the Perils and Promises of Spiritual Life, co-author of Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. And I was reading through this book and I got stuck on teacher. I got to the chapter about teacher and I'm like, I don't want somebody telling me how to do my spiritual life, you know? And then I found this practice. So he has some great things to say on the issue of starting over. I pulled this one out because I remembered that there was an entire chapter called Training the Puppy. Training the Puppy, Mindfulness of Breathing, right? It's about when you bring the mind back, you wouldn't yank a puppy, you know, on a short leash and grab them back onto the blanket and, you know, you would gently kind of just over and over again bring them back, right? There's that caring and that kindness there. So he quotes, interestingly enough, I grew up Catholic, he quotes St. Francis de Sales. The Salesians, I don't know if you know how many of you are Catholics, but remember the Salesian missionaries, 1567 to 1622. And he says this, what we need is a cup of understanding, a barrel of love, and an ocean of patience. Bring yourself back to the point quite gently. He's talking about meditation here. Bring yourself back to the point quite gently. And even if you do nothing during the whole of your hour, but bring your heart back 1,000 times, though it went away every time you brought it back, your hour would be very well employed. So he's talking about meditation here. And, you know, there are different theories for this. One is that the practice actually is starting over. So if you bring it back 1,000 times, you've succeeded 1,000 times. The other one that I just heard is pretty good. It's like, well, you were sitting here and your mind was wandering off 1,000 times and you sat here for an hour. That meant you weren't out there for an hour doing harm to somebody. Sort of the better than alternative argument. So, even if you do nothing during the whole of your hour but bring your heart back 1,000 times, though it went away every time you brought it back, your hour would be very well employed. So that's some encouragement in the micro moments of our sitting practice. I just got back from retreats, or sort of had retreat on the mind, and several of you in the room I know were also there. It's great to see you in this context. And one of the issues on retreat, so obviously in the retreat you're sitting a lot, so you can apply all this stuff from the first section. But one of the things about retreat is that once you've done one, look out. Because the next one you do, you either want it to be exactly like the first one, only a little better, or you want it to be nothing like that last one, which was such a disaster, and why am I here again anyway? You know, there's this tendency that teachers, retreat teachers, talk about to somehow magically forget all of the pain and misery and remember that 5 minutes of, you know, insight or whatever it might be. So retreat offers a special opportunity to try to start anew. So first of all, you know, allowing each retreat to be its own experience and not expecting it to, you know, build on the last one or be just like the last one, which is so great, or, I got it wrong last time, let me get it right this time. You know, that comparing mind is just deadly. So we have to watch out for that. The other thing is that the retreat, like the arc of our practice in our lives, which I'll be talking about in a bit, has an arc to it. There's a structure to it that is intentionally built to bring us in from the chaos of our daily lives, settle us down a bit, actually give us the opportunity to be aware for a few moments, and then bring us back out so that we can take whatever we've gained on the retreat back into our daily life and inform that in some way. And so each day brings a different experience. So at the beginning, I mean, I don't know about you, but for many, many people, including myself, the first day or two is just about staying awake. Yeah. Now that's why this quote, I'm going to have that next to my bed next time, about, you know, falling asleep and drifting off for quite a long time and then just resuming the practice. Yeah. Honestly, it's because of the punishing pace of our lives in this culture. Many of us are sleep deprived, and even if we're getting enough hours of sleep at night, the pace of our daily lives in the waking hour is so punishing that you bring this mind and body into a retreat, and you shut out all the outside stimuli, and you're not running around and doing errands all day long, and the to-do list is back home. All of a sudden, to be in that, I mean, it's almost like slamming into a brick wall. You know, you're just going full speed, and there's full stop. And to be able to adapt to that takes a little bit of time to work into that. And then once you do, you know, the experiences sort of unfold in a fairly predictable way, in that, you know, often, once we get past the sleepiness and we keep the body still, there's this discomfort in the body that starts arising. And it's always there. We just don't notice that we're sort of constantly shifting and moving when we're here to relieve the minor discomforts that arise in the body. And it's just the nature of the body, is that if you keep the body still, discomfort arises. And in our daily life, we're constantly just adjusting for that. We don't like unpleasant, and we really like pleasant, so we're constantly doing that. Well, when you're aware of your body in a retreat, which is part of the way the whole thing is structured, does it make you aware, then that discomfort is just allowed to blossom, and you get to experience, oh, what does the mind do with unpleasant? Interesting. I wonder if I react to unpleasant in anything like that same way in my daily life. You know, you learn a lot. part of the reason for the structure. So we have different things as the retreat goes on. And of course, as we get settled in, as we kind of get used to the discomfort in the body and learn to accept that rather than fight it, because when it first comes on, you're fighting it, so it makes it worse. And, you know, eventually we settle into some level of calm and peace, or some level of connection with our own emotional turmoil, but in a setting where we can actually be with that. And so that's a relief in itself. We don't have to cover up. We don't have to pretend we're somewhere else. We don't have to tell people, oh, I'm fine, and you're really not. All of that. And so, you know, it unfolds in its own way. And, you know, this strange thing happens with the community, just as we experience on a small level here earlier, where we meditate together for a half hour or so. And, you know, we're not talking to anyone around, but there is this support, this feeling of support that we get from having other people with the same intention in the room with us and feeling completely safe, or at least safe enough to stay in the room. So that same thing happens on retreat. But since it's longer, it develops to a bit more of an extent. So you have this feeling of community supporting us, supporting our intention. And so we can just be who we are. We don't have to be anything special. And that's really sweet. There is a saying among retreat teachers, of whom I am not one, by the way, that there's nothing like a good sitting to ruin your whole day. And what that refers to is our natural tendency to prefer calm, tranquil, peaceful, etc., to, you know, the turmoil of what life often brings us and meditation often brings us. And so this quote was from a person that went on retreat and told the teachers later, you know, nothing like a good sitting to ruin your whole day, because, you know, the second or third day, once she'd settled down into the retreat, she had this sit where just everything was wonderful and calm and blissful and all of that. And then, of course, the next time she sat down, she tried to recreate that experience. And I think most of us know from experience, you try to do anything and it's going to kind of create its opposite. So in this case, trying to hang on to peace or create tranquility is going to cause worry and restlessness and all of that. It's not going to happen. So that's just a reminder that we need to treat each sitting, whether it's, you know, our day-to-day sittings or the morning sitting, the afternoon sitting on a retreat, as just like each breath, just a completely new arising experience, and just take it for what it is in the moment. So broadening, yes.
I'm not sure I understand. Starting over.
Yes.
Moment where you are.
Yes.
So what are you starting over?
You're starting over with refreshing the awareness. You're bringing the awareness into play again when it's sort of been either submerged in dullness and sleepiness, or it's been carried off by a train of thought. So you're starting over by refreshing the attention to notice whatever is present in this moment.
So past is not erased.
No. Past conditions everything that we experience now.
So when you say starting over, it's not exactly...
not a clean slate.
It's a specific starting.
Yeah, it's a specific starting over of refreshing the attention and just saying, okay, doesn't matter that I was just lost in thought for 20 minutes. I'm not going to worry about that, try to analyze it, figure it out, do a psychoanalysis of what that strange demon that appeared means, or any of that. I'm just going to start over in this moment, and I'm going to connect with the next in-breath. The start of the next in-breath, I'm actually going to connect my attention with that and be with that and try to, as best I can, stay with that. For the duration of that in-breath and of the next out-breath, and then next in-breath, next out-breath. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that clarification. So what made me think about the overall arc of practice is the fact that we just started our latest edition of the beginning meditation class. Many of you are here. Great to see you here as well. And before the class starts, we ask people to submit a questionnaire. And we ask them, you know, oh, have you ever meditated before? And if so, and then the first night of the class, we ask people, well, why are you here? You know, just like we did at the beginning of the sitting, what's your intention? Why are you here and what do you expect out of the class? And we get many people who have never meditated at all. We get a number of people who say, well, I used to have a meditation practice, but it sort of drifted away and I want to get back some consistency. So, and that's wisdom speaking. You know, the understanding that a consistent meditation practice is more effective than an inconsistent one. So it's more than just, I think that expression of, you know, want to get some consistency is more than just grasping, you know, oh, I want to meditate every day just to show what a warrior I am. It's not that. I don't get that at all when I hear this expression of I want some consistency in my practice. I think it's a genuine wisdom. It's an understanding that there are benefits to a consistent practice. But the reality is that, like life itself, our practice goes through this series of ups, downs, plateaus, valleys, peaks, etc. It is not a linear progression, pilgrim's progress, you know, start at the bottom of the mountain, end up on the top in a straight line at all. Jack in this book quotes Ram Dass from Be Here Now. He says, at first you will think of practice as a limited part of your life. In time you will realize that everything you do is part of practice. So I had an interesting take on that on this retreat. I was the manager. And I'd been manager once before, about 10 years ago, also for John Travis, by the way. John was a teacher this time. And he's such a great person to be a manager for. So 10 years ago when I was manager, I remember quite distinctly thinking that when I was running around doing manager duties, it was framed in my mind as chores, errand, work, that realm, right? And then when I didn't have to do those things and I was able to join the other yogis sitting or walking or listening to a Dharma talk, it was practice.
Making a separation,
yeah. And as we know, you know, all separations are artificial. We make them all up. So this time, I don't know what it was, maybe just the more practice, the whole thing was practice, all of it, you know? Mm-hmm. If I was fortunate enough to be in the sitting, which I was for most sittings, that was wonderful. And if I was fortunate enough to be listening to someone's story about, I don't mean a made-up story in a negative way, I mean something that had just happened in their lives that they needed to talk to me about, that was practice. Mm-hmm. So it was really, I really felt this quote from Ram Dass. At first you will think of practice as a limited part of your life. In time you will realize that everything you do is part of practice. So I think that's part of the arc of practice. And actually often many of these folks that report that they're back in the beginning class because their sitting meditation practice has sort of gotten inconsistent, when you probe a little deeper, they actually have incorporated quite a bit of the teaching into their daily life. That's what brought them back. That's what helped them remember that this is important. You know, I mean, I think if they were not doing the sitting practice and they were out there, you know, breaking all five precepts at once and, you know, they wouldn't say, oh, I need a consistent meditation practice, you know, to get my life in order here. You know, I think what happened is that the effect of the earlier meditation practice actually had them in a place where they're at least in talking to some of them more deeply, that actually they're living it to some extent in their life. They're living this out. It's become part of their life, but they want to make it stronger. And as we know, you know, the sitting practice informs the daily practice, and the daily practice informs the sitting practice. So if we're out there breaking all five precepts at once and we try to sit down and concentrate, good luck with that. You know, the mind is just going to be so disturbed that you're not going to be able to do anything. Whereas, you know, once you've gotten those things under control and your intentions are solid and your actions are actually in somewhat alignment with your intentions, then the sitting practice goes more smoothly, and then the insights from that are informing the daily life. Jack says, if we have ideas how our practice should unfold, that should, you know, you always know there's something going on there, right? These will often get in the way, preventing us from honoring the phase that is actually with us. Phase, so right there. He's not saying, hey, you know, practice is one big chunk from the first day I sit down to the day I achieve nirvana. He's not saying that at all. He's saying, if we have ideas about how our practice should unfold, these will often get in the way, preventing us from honoring the phase that is actually with us. Honoring. Not just saying, I'm going to put up with this phase of my life where I'm the primary caregiver for someone that's demanding 23 hours of my day. No. Honoring the phase that is now actually with us. Practice cannot follow our ideals. It can only follow the laws of life.
I will say that again.
Practice cannot follow our ideals. He doesn't say, often our practice does not follow our ideals. He says, practice cannot follow our ideals. It can only follow the laws of life. Amen. So I think back to the story that Kamala often tells when she was raising teenagers and when Indraji was living in her house in Hawaii. And she got into a fight with one of her teenage girls, and the teenager went running off to her bedroom and slammed the door. And she was visibly upset. And Munindra just put his hand on her arm and he said, surrender to the law. And these are these laws of life that Jack is talking about. Arc of our practice follows the laws of life, the natural laws. You know, as Sayadaw Tejaniya says, you know, this is all nature. It's just nature unfolding. It's the laws of the way things are. You know, vipassana means seeing clearly the way things are. That's our object. That's what we're trying to do. So, you know, if we get deluded once in a while, that's okay. Seeing clearly is the end goal of this practice. You know, and if we get a glimpse every once in a while, it's kind of nice. But don't beat yourself up if you don't get that glimpse all that often. Practice can only follow the laws of life. Can only follow nature. So we need to treat each phase of our life as being brand new. We need to, as he says, honor the phase that is actually with us. There have been, you know, as we know, if we pay half a mind to the news, there is just constant renewal of suffering with a big S every day, not just the discontentedness and the sort of ennui that we may experience, but I mean, you know, earthquakes, hurricanes, wildfires, etc., etc. You know, we're celebrating. We are remembering the one-year anniversary of hurricane in Puerto Rico. And I thought, well, you know, it's one thing to say start over in your meditation with the next in-breath, But what if your entire physical environment was completely destroyed? What would that be like starting over? So I looked back to see what some of the folks that lost their homes in Santa Rosa, you know, as many of you know, our retreat center that we've used since 2004 in Santa Rosa was destroyed by that fire a year ago. And I found this quote by the person who was fortunate enough to have the first house that was rebuilt after that fire. The fire was October 9th. He was back in his house by May of 2018. There's a company in Lake County that specializes in building the first house somewhere after a disaster. That's his deal. Yeah, he did it for a fire in Lake County, and then it's like, okay, that's my new deal. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build the first house after every disaster that I can get to. So this gentleman had his house rebuilt, and it's quite touching to look at the photograph of this house sitting in the middle of a subdivision of burnt foundations, and it's the only one. It's a brand new house, and just surrounded by burnt foundations. But he was fortunate when they tested his foundation, it didn't have any contamination. So this is what he said. Little did I know, when I left here on October 9th, it would take me 8 months to get back in. It's exciting to have hot and cold water. Hot and cold water. You know, we take that for granted. And I mean, I think when we look to Puerto Rico and think about the fact that they just got their electricity on a month or two ago, it's very easy to think of people off there not having hot and cold water, right? But I mean, we kind of assume that we're going to have hot and cold water. But watch out for assumptions, because you're losing an opportunity for awareness. Every time you make an assumption, that's an opportunity for awareness that just slipped by. Because rather than pay attention to what was right here, we made some kind of assumption, which meant that we were depending on a concept rather than on the clear seeing of the reality that was right in front of us. So ever since then, when I turn on that tap, I think this gentleman is very wise. And he came out of this. He's starting over. He recognizes it. He's not taking anything for granted. And he is excited to have hot and cold water, as we all should be, right? We're very, very fortunate. Jack says in this book, each stage of our life holds the seeds for spiritual growth. Our spiritual life matures when we consciously accept the life tasks appropriate for us. At times, we get to choose the cycles we work with, such as choosing to get married or beginning a career. At these times, it is helpful to meditate to reflect on which direction will bring us closer to our path with heart. More often, we don't get to choose. The great cycles of life wash over us, presenting us with challenges and difficult rites of passage much bigger than our ideas of where we are going. Okay? So that's about assumptions, right? We have these ideas of where we're going and what the practice is going to do for us and what. And when I started this practice, did I ever think I'd be sitting here? No. No. And I don't take it for granted. I take this very seriously. With humor. If we couldn't laugh at it, we wouldn't be taking it seriously enough. But I love that the great cycles of life are much bigger than our ideas of where we are going. So, you know, if we could actually live not from our ideas of where we were going, but where we actually were, how different life would be. And I think that's the charge of this practice of the Buddhist teachings, is to, in every moment, look for those Four Noble Truths, to actually look, to recognize suffering, discontent, dissatisfaction when it's happening, so that we don't just fall on our old habits to try to get out of it, or old harmful habits of how to get out of it, you know, to actually remember, recognize, and abandon craving, that liking and disliking, pushing away and grabbing onto that causes so much suffering, to remember that that's why we're suffering. It's not because of that object out there, it's because of our relationship to it, that craving, that tanha. To remember that there actually is the hope that if we keep practicing, that this suffering will in some degree be relieved. And then to remember the Eightfold Path, that, you know, this is not, if we're really practicing these teachings, we know that it's not a one-fold path, that mindfulness isn't going to do it, you know, that it's going to take right view, right intention, all of the elements of sila, livelihood, action, practicing the precepts, all of that, and that it's going to take some effort, balanced effort, gentle, persevering effort, but it is going to take some effort to develop mindfulness and concentration. That's the Eightfold Path that it's going to take to bring our lives into balance. And the other thing that I haven't brought up yet, but that is obvious when you think about it, is it takes humility to start over. Starting over, before you can do that, you need to admit that maybe what was just happening a moment before wasn't skillful, that's discernment, right? That's wisdom, is being able, that's the definition of it, being able to discern skillful from unskillful. So, but to actually admit that, you know, that wandering off, that not actually taking advantage of this gift of awareness that we have, of letting it go because of lack of energy or because lack of resolve or whatever it might be, that we want to cultivate that in a way that honors the practice, and that also expresses the humility that we aren't doing the practice is doing us. And the willingness to start over, that in itself is an expression of humility in the best sense of the word. The other thing that I thought about in terms of starting over is, you know, we have Susan's beautiful picture here and the remembrances of her over there. And I mean, this center, in large part, you know, it was a community effort, but it wouldn't take much of a stretch to say we wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for Susan Orr. I mean, she was so central to that effort. So recognizing that, and then, you know, there was that email, I don't know if all of you get the Dharma Center emails, but there was one in August, late August, where Linda Decker and John Penfield were also stepping down off the board when Susan left the board, all three of them. And they, all three of them were on the very first boards here, and then Susan and John were on the feasibility study phase even before the board formed that Jerry and I were on, about deciding, well, can we even do this? Can three sanghas even get together? And we did that for a year, and Susan was on that, and John, and Linda, all of them. And they all stepped off the board at once. And yet here we are, you know, the walls haven't collapsed. So in some very real sense, we are starting over, where, you know, the Dharma Center is moving beyond those, what the email called the pioneers. And it's in great hands. You know, we've got Bob here, who's the building manager, who's been so steadfast since the day the doors opened. And just so many of you that are contributing to the financial support of this place, folks that are serving on the board, on the SDC board, folks from SIM. So in some real sense, we're starting over with this Dharma Center because the pillars of that initial effort have moved on in their lives. You know, we talked about the arc of practice, the arc of our lives. They've moved on, Susan, in some even more mysterious way. And yet, here we are. You know, we certainly the past is informed, the fact that we're here, but this moment is now. And we can, honor that past, but we can also resolve to actually live in this moment and start anew with this center and make it whatever it can be. The same thing applies to Sacramento Insight Meditation. For the first time since day one, we have a board where none of the mentors or Dennis are on the board. You know, that's a first, and we're working with how do we communicate best, and we'll work some things out, and one of us tries to attend each of the meetings and have communication back and forth. We have some retreats, but that built-in factor of having someone physically present for every meeting isn't there. We're offering a beginning class this right now. We just started Tuesday, and Dennis isn't teaching it.
Face it, 5, 10, 15 years, I'm not going to be up here. It's going to be somebody else, you know?
It's just the way it is. So just knowing, I think, that's sort of the, speaking of our friend that was talking to us about impermanence at the beginning, reminding us again and again about impermanence. If we can get to the point where we can actually realize impermanence to some deeper level than just, oh, the leaves change color in the fall, if we can actually understand that there is no place to stand, and if we can rest in that, you know, that brings a freshness and an aliveness to life that we can't get it any other way. And so just understanding that 5, 10, 15 years from now, I'm not going to be sitting up here. Somebody else can be sitting up here, and, you know, chances are it's going to be even better, right? Chances are, because of the effort all of you have put in and the building on it and all of that, it'll be a brand new moment, but, you know, just resting in the trust and the humility that we're not going to be here, but it going to be something better. And, you know, causes and conditions allowing, wouldn't it be wonderful to imagine that this Sangha could be here when none of us are here? Mm-hmm. You know? Which sort of gives us a level of responsibility that, again, don't make any assumptions. Just remember that any decisions we make now have these far-reaching ripples that affect those around us in ways that we cannot predict. There is no way that we can know what a kind word to a newcomer on a Thursday night will ripple out to. You know, that might be the teacher that is sitting up here in 10 years. So resting in the impermanence of knowing that things are going to change and just letting go just a little bit so that we can allow that change to just unroll in its own way without our having to stop it, because we're not going to be able to do that, or control it in some way, but just allowing it to roll would be a great gift for this community. So I think with that, I will open the floor for questions, comments, complaints. And if someone wouldn't, since I'm tethered here, if someone wouldn't mind handing the newly recharged microphone around. If you could speak into it, it'll just be easier for others to hear you and for the recording to hear you. Questions, comments, thoughts, reflections, stories of when starting over worked for you?
You mentioned earlier about the phase that we're in. Could you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah. Speaking about either life or about our meditation practice, it's not this sort of smooth linear progression. You know, we have these ups and we have these downs. And then we have these barren periods, you know, in the Christian tradition it's called the dark night of the soul, where we feel like, oh, geez, my practice is just not working and it's falling apart and I just can't last for 5 minutes when I try to sit down and all of that. And to not feel like something has gone wrong, but to actually rest in that, in whatever it is at that moment, and to accept it for what it is, and then to move through with it as it is. So the phases are, you know, there are times in our practice, like early on, we've got all this bright faith and we're really informed and we're just so excited and we don't know anything, but we're just really, you know, wow, this practice is great. I feel like I'm home and poof. And that carries you for a while, right? And then, you know, you hear a teaching that just kind of knocks you off your center. And it's like, okay, that bright faith isn't good enough anymore. Until it gets embodied a little bit with some experience, it's not going to sustain you. So you get a teaching, something that knocks you off your center meant that it actually brought in a new insight. Because if it isn't surprising, it's not an insight. It's just something you knew already. So, okay, you knocked off center and you move to the new center, and then you move on from there. So we go through these phases. Steve Armstrong, I haven't experienced this, but Steve Armstrong talks about in the stages of insight, there's a place where you get to a place in your practice where you think you've just completely fallen apart. You know, you can't concentrate from one moment to the next, and things are arising and passing away so quickly, you can't follow any of it, and you feel like your life's a complete mess, and the teacher's like, oh, great, keep going, you know. You go to your teacher report, oh, my practice is a complete mess, I've failed, you know, and the teacher says, no, your practice is really great, keep going. So sometimes it's often quite difficult to recognize whether the phase we're in is good, bad, or indifferent, but it does go through phases. It's not just sort of linear progression, one thing building on the other, and, you know. Yeah. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, in life, we go through joy, we go through grief, and we learn from each of those, right? So.
So I was thinking about, you know, the starting over aspect, and I was thinking about asking questions at the end of Dharma talks, you know, and it's always a little... should I ask that? Is that a little too basic to ask, you know? And I've been hanging around all this time. It's like, but that's just a form of starting over, as near as I can tell. I mean, I really identify with the waves of mm-hmm. practice and awareness, mm-hmm. you know, of, I mean, I think I just lost it for about a year. So maybe I'm coming back a little bit now, you know, type thing. You know, it's that significant. So, yeah. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. We always tell the beginning class, you know, every question you ask is already in the minds of 10 other people. Mm-hmm. So you're really performing a service when you ask that question. And it's a little easier in the beginning class, right? Because even for those that have been practicing for a while, you know that they're with a beginner's mind or they wouldn't be there. But yeah, in here it's the same thing. Every question that's asked is probably on somebody else's mind. So go ahead and ask it.
Hopefully this isn't too far out comment, but I'm over the last few years I've been surprised at how often I'm willing to settle for the present moment kind of being okay with the habit that I have versus being open to whatever might happen in this moment. It could be good or bad, but it will be different, and it could be really much, much better, but I'd much rather kind of be like a cat, you know, it's okay, so don't disturb them during the moment. And I just, that's just a really strong habit of my own mind, okay? Yeah, I'm getting along okay here, you know. So it's the whole question of what dukkha really is, right? And, I'm not so aware of the dukkha in this moment, so it's okay. So it's okay. Maybe I'll just kind of walk around it, you know, not really participate in it. Mm. And that way there won't be any barking dog at me, but there's no potential for something new and wonderful to happen okay. every moment, too. So,
okay.
Anyway.
So that's a sort of a form of acceptance, but maybe not much awareness there.
Yeah, I think it's more of a form of avoidance.
Okay.
Or maybe sort of intentionally delusional.
A spiritual bypass.
Yeah. Something like that. It's very complicated in my own mind to see all the little pieces of it and how it develops. I'll see the moment, and I'll see my immediate attempt to manage that moment. It's like, wow, how did I ever learn to do that? This is so much work to manage all these moments. did I develop that, or was I taught that, or was I always afraid of the present moment, or something like that? So it probably sounds like I'm a basket case, but that's sort of where I am all this stuff. It's like, wow, I just can't be there for what's here without a lot of work right now, you know. So anyway, that's my weather report for today.
Thank you for the clarity of that.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Rich. This is very timely for me, of course, but I was thinking as you were talking that somehow even the phrase starting over can feel like Sisyphus. Groundhog Day, I got to do this again, I'm going to do this again, I'm going to do this again. And to see it instead as those pixels or as something, it's a renewal of the effort of the gentle persistence instead of starting over, that can feel very bogged down if you conceptualize it that way.
That's right. Yeah, Sisyphus is trying to get somewhere, right?
Yeah.
He's trying to get that rock to the top of the mountain.
Right.
That was his problem. You know? I mean, if he'd been okay with a rock at the bottom of the hill, he wouldn't have had to work so hard.
There you go, Michael. There's your comfort.
Right. Yeah, and that's really where the patience comes in too, right? To recognize, you know, okay, I'm starting over, but with renewed interest, you know.
Like many of us, overeducated and compulsively self-aware types that got here in the latter stages of our lives and careers, it's hard not to conceive of anything as something that shouldn't be mastered, conquered, whatever. And frankly, a lot of in our tradition that it's hard not to see it that way, given the sort of the taxonomy, the lists, so on. Hey, starting from Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Precepts, on and on and on, you know, the factors of awakening, whatever. And, you know, it's natural to think that, well, I got to know these, you know, because, what if somebody asked me?
What if there's a final exam?
And, you know, I wrestled with that for a long time, but I remember when I, quite a while back, when I was on one of the first retreats I was on, I finally arrived without, you know, magically almost at that point where I just felt complete at that moment. And of course, I had to run and tell somebody afterwards. And their reaction was, well, just you wait. You know, when you really know, then, you know, you'll be on the fifth jhana and you'll be, you know, it's real equanimity and blah, 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 you know. And I hardly knew what they were talking about, but I felt awful but it's hard not to, and when you're talking about, I really like the idea of having that fundamental understanding be about not those things, but about the arc of all of our lives. I spent a long time up in Placerville and moved down here a little while back, and we spent a long time getting the nuns up there situated in their monastery, and I know a lot of them are, you have them here, and talk about having to start over, you know, both of when they were in England, and there we're talking about, you know, having to, you know, not only chart a new life for themselves, but for all the ideas and for a whole gender of, you know, half the population that, you know, is interested or, you know, wants to know this this tradition, this program. And it makes, you know, most of what we consider, you know, pale by comparison. But those are the important things, not the lists. I'm no good at those. Thanks.
Thank you.
I have a question. Oh,
perfect. So when you're going through those stages where you're not able to focus as much, have you ever shortened the amount of time you meditate, or do you just consistently stay with the same time and just be like, okay, well, I'm screwed up for an hour? Mm-hmm. You're not screwed up, but you know what I mean? Yeah, I can't focus for an hour. Have you ever tried just going, okay, I'm going to go 5 minutes today or whatever?
Yeah, so I'm not talking about that stage of insight that Steve was talking about. I'm talking about ordinary just restlessness. So, you know, when I first started the beginning class, I could not sit for 10 minutes. So what I would do is I would deal with the physical energy. You know, restlessness is one of the hindrances, one of the five hindrances. I'd leave my office on my bike, and I'd ride home. It was 15 miles. And just before I got off the bike trail, there were these nice benches, and I'd leave my bike on the bench and sit on that bench. So I'd gotten enough of that physical energy out to be able to actually settle for 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. So there are antidotes that we can do to these hindrances, these things that get in the way of our ability to practice. And when it's a straight, you know, physical thing like that, those are effective. When it's more of an attitude of mind, then we need to just really look that in the face. And maybe what that requires, yeah, is not forcing yourself to try to have some pattern that you think should unfold, you know, that, oh, well, if I don't do 15 minutes this week and 20 minutes a week after that, then, you know, something's seriously wrong. But to actually confront in a positive way, look right in the eye, the mental attitude that's causing the problem, and then try to work through that and understand it, then that could be skillful as well. But, you know, if it's just a, you know, if your knee hurt because you're sitting cross-legged, get in a chair. You know, I mean, there are ways of dealing with things that are very straightforward. If it's a much larger issue, I mean, like, you know, the example I used earlier, you know, you're caring for somebody 23 hours a day. Well, that's your practice, you know. Being with that person 23 hours a day is your practice. You know, it's not going to help anything to go off and, you know, disappear for an hour when they might need something in that hour. So, I mean, every situation is different, but don't feel like because you have to do an end run around something, you're necessarily avoiding or showing aversion or anything like that. Sometimes just applying an antidote is a skillful way to take on something.
In terms of a tendency to judge the quality of one's meditation, Gil Fronsdahl quotes another teacher as saying, meditation is like a rodeo. You win if you're still on the cushion when the timer goes off.
I just got back from a retreat in May, and we meditated not just sitting, you know, we also meditated while we ate. And so when you ate, you see a bowl in front of you of food, you don't just start gobbling it down, you know. You just sit and be aware of it for, you know, maybe a minute or 2 minutes before you dive in, and then take every bite, you know, slowly and taste every savory flavor within it. And then afterwards, we had to do our washing dishes meditation, you know. So we went up and felt the water, the warm water and the soap, and how slippery it was in our hand, and wiped our dish and made sure that was nice and clean. Put it in the colder water to rinse it and set it on a rack, you know. And that was part of our a meditation. It wasn't just sitting there for 30 minutes. We had service meditation, where we had to kind of, you know, clean up the bookstore, or, you know, I like to go to the bookstore because I like counting. It's just engineer stuff. But they also did walking meditation afterwards, you know, with the, you know, all gathered at the bell tower, and we did walking meditation for an hour. So, you know, I try to find things during the day to meditate. And I actually, when I wash my hands after using the bathroom, yeah, I don't know. Maybe some of the guys, I mean, at work, there's a lot of people there that go in and out of the bathroom. But I may be there for a couple of minutes, you know, just feeling the soap going over my hand and just feeling water and just going through every nail, you know, and just having that as my meditation. So there's a lot of opportunities where you don't have to just sit and watch your thoughts go by. You can also practice it all the time, you know. So anyway, that's kind of my little spiel there.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's a good reminder. We've been talking about starting over tonight, but actually continuity of awareness is extremely valuable. As you say, you know, bringing it from one activity to the next and just keeping that connection with our experience alive. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. All right, well, let's close with a recognition that we're not in this alone, that this practice, if it's working, will connect us with all beings everywhere, both in recognizing their suffering and in remembering that, just like us, all beings want to be happy. And so dedicating whatever positive energy we have generated here by practicing together, by encouraging awareness, by supporting each other's practice, dedicating that to relieving the suffering of all beings. May all beings be safe and protected, peaceful and happy. May all beings be as healthy and as strong as their current circumstances allow. And may all beings be free from suffering. Thank you for your practice.